From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in places across Rochester and Western New York, and I'm going to list a few of them. No doubt you've been to some of these. You drive past them, you've seen them. Sibley Square, Eastman Gardens, the Button Lofts, the Lincoln Alliance Building, the Terminal Building, the Bavona Building at One Mount Hope, the Hilton Garden Inn, the Holy Rosary Apartments. That's a short list of projects that got off the ground around here, thanks to something called the Federal Historic Tax Credit. In fact, most or all of these projects never get started without the tax credit. The Trump White House wants to eliminate the tax credit, and it could very well happen. Some conservatives argue that the tax credit is just another form of government largesse that should go away. After all, if these projects are viable, they should be able to get going without a subsidy, right? But supporters say the credit is designed to pay for itself in the long run. And without it, we could lose some cornerstones of our community and some big development projects to come. Here to discuss at this hour are our guests in studio. Larry Francer is Associate Director of Preservation for the Landmark Society of Western New York. Larry, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Patrick Dutton is a local developer and broker focused on downtown Rochester. Patrick, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Evan.
Daniel McKay is Deputy Commissioner for Historic Preservation at the Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation out of Albany. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Pleased to be in Rochester.
And Dan McEnany is Public Outreach Coordinator for the New York State Division for Historic Preservation. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks.
Larry, I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to read a little bit of a recent guest essay in the Democrat and Chronicle from Philip Borelli and Jason Yachts, because what I want to do is establish a little bit of the history behind this tax credit that kind of tells us where it came from and why it was started in the first place. So, quoting from their essay, quote, "The decades that followed World War II devastated many American cities. Hardest hit were the Rust Belt cities of the Northeast and the Midwest, where massive population loss was exacerbated by industrial and infrastructure disinvestment, as well as ill-conceived urban renewal plans. This loss of people and employers created a number of challenging legacies for Rust Belt cities, including concentrated poverty, widespread environmental contamination, and a lot of old, underutilized buildings. The historic tax credit was created in the late 1970s as the first meaningful counterweight to the extensive demolition programs of the urban renewal era of the 1950s and 60s. The program was retooled in 1986 and now provides a 20% federal tax credit to an owner that completes the substantial rehab of a certified historic structure," end quote. There's a little bit of the history. That about sums up pretty accurately?
Yeah, that's great. That's the story.
And here in Rochester, how often is the historic tax credit needed, invoked, used right here?
There, as you mentioned at the beginning, mm-hmm. with that list, I mean, I've got a list of 15 projects that have been done using the tax credits, and they just wouldn't be happening. I mean, right now there are in progress, there are three specific projects, the Lincoln Alliance Building, the Terminal Building, Sibley Square. Those are happening as we speak. Patrick's here. He can tell us about ones that he's looking at that have to happen right away. I mean, we are working with developers constantly, explaining to them about the tax credits, helping them with their applications. It's if you look at specifically downtown, you know, our sort of center city, nothing that's happening there in terms of the renovation and bringing back our center city so that it can be safer, so that it can feel like a neighborhood again. None of that would be happening without these tax credit projects.
What is the latest on this? We've heard this for a number of weeks now, and we've heard rumblings that, you know, could be slashed, eliminated, et cetera. What is the very latest?
I'm going to hand that over to Daniel because
okay. Yeah. Yeah,
he's
Daniel,
the man.
What's the latest on that?
So we're dealing with a situation where there's a concern in both the Senate and House tax reform legislation. There are two different proposals in each house. The House proposal, which will be voted on this coming Thursday, completely eliminates the federal tax credit incentive for historic rehabilitation purposes. And so an existing 20% credit will be cut to zero. There'll be basically a 30-month transition window. And after that, no project will be able to proceed.
That's in the vote that happens tomorrow?
Thursday, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what are your expectations? I mean, it's part of the bill. It's sort of tied to the bill. But what have you been doing to try to get it? You know, there's no hope to get it removed, or is there any movement at all on that?
So the play is to get it reinserted into the tax, you know, the ultimate tax reform legislation. The House is proposing elimination. The Senate is proposing curtailing the program from 20 to 10%. That's a slightly, you know, that Senate bill is on a slightly separate calendar and requires a slightly different type of advocacy at this point. Even though this is a priority for a city like Rochester, obviously other concerns about the overall tax reform plan have dominated the news, represent, you know, other significant political concerns locally and on a statewide basis. But there has finally been an effort, a very consistent statewide effort by developers to contact House members and say, you're undercutting one of the most significant economic development tools in the federal tax code. This is a program that has served virtually all 50 states with some effect. Has served the Northeast and Rust Belt communities with particular effectiveness. Two-thirds of the federal program activity right now are occurring in upstate New York. There's a complementary state credit that has pulled the federal credit upstate, and the volume of activity that's occurring in Rochester, the volume of activity that's occurring in places like Syracuse and Buffalo will not be replicated through in any other way. The tax reform effort will not replace this particular incentive.
But is it too late? Do you think anyone is listening in Congress?
Well, I think, you know, obviously there's a stated deadline for tax reform to be achieved. We're hearing that from President Trump. We're hearing that from Republican leaders in both the House and Senate. If the House gets to a bill, passes a bill this week, and people are bailing. Republicans are pulling out of this, out of support for this legislation. And we're seeing that in New York specifically. There still needs to be reconciliation with the Senate bill. The Senate bill is lagging behind on that calendar. There's still an attempt to get this program restored in full in the Senate version. And then there has to be reconciliation. And there's so many fundamental disagreements between the House and Senate bills on this issue and many others that I feel like the ideal calendar is slipping. And so I do believe there is still a significant opportunity to restore this program. It really has worked so productively in so many states, and it would be a shame for representatives in the Senate and the House nationwide to fail to realize that. So there's a very important, very effective, very significant federal lobbying effort underway now.
Let's turn to Patrick Dutton for some specifics on how this works and the impact here. So Patrick is a developer and broker focused on downtown Rochester. Projects that you've been involved with that people would know include what, Patrick?
I would say the highest profile project right now is the conversion of Chase Tower into what is known as the Metropolitan, a mixed-use building. 26 stories, our city's second tallest building. But a lot of other neighborhood, smaller redevelopment projects taking historic buildings and making them fantastic. One particular building that was completed this past year was the Bevier Memorial Building. A famous local architect, Claude Bragdon, completed it. It was home of the fine arts classroom building for the predecessor to RIT. This building sat vacant for close to 18 years. And it's only the tax credits that enabled this building to proceed. Without them, this building would likely still be vacant or underperforming at best. But meanwhile, we have a stately building that's a critical part of our city's history. It's back online. It's income producing. It's people's homes. Business has relocated there. It's on a corner in a nice part of the city that otherwise would sit dark in the evening. And there's life that's happening. And there's buildings like the Bevier Building that have only proceeded to be redeveloped throughout our center city and some of our neighborhoods only with the introduction of the federal and state historic tax credits.
All right, so those are projects you've been involved with. What's happening right now? And do you feel like you're on kind of a deadline? If this sunsets or if this goes away, could it impact development that's happening in Rochester right now?
So right now, as a developer, I have to take the approach as though this is going away. This is a federal tax credit that is now disappearing. I have to take that approach because if I think that maybe it's going to be saved, several of my projects that have been in the works for several years are in grave danger. Two buildings that are right near the center of downtown, Main and Clinton, a long vacant, dilapidated block, the former Renaissance Square. There's two very historic buildings. We worked with the state and the Landmark Society to create a historic district because this is a historic block in so many ways. So we worked for well over a year with the state to create a district, thereby making these buildings eligible. And now that they're eligible, we're under the gun to get them into the program before the program escapes us and is lost to tax reform. So that's one project. Another is the historic Edwards Department Store, long part of our city's history. This is a 150,000 square foot building, and it's a $24 million project. If we don't get this project started now and in queue with the tax credits as part of the solution, the building doesn't happen. This is another building that's been sat vacant for well over a decade. I mean, Xerox and Excellus, Blue Cross Blue Shield, used to occupy the buildings. They've long moved out. I mean, it's close to 20 years that these businesses have moved out. It's been vacant a long time.
I'm not doing my job if I don't push you a little and have you answer, why do you need those credits? You're a developer. I think in recent political campaigns, the word developer has been tossed around to imply someone who makes a lot of money and then gets a lot of government benefits on top of that. Can't you do these projects without a tax credit?
Some projects you probably can, without question. Some projects, without question, you cannot. The buildings on Main Street, literally, the insides are falling in on itself. I don't bring people into the building. I can no longer access the second through sixth stories of my building without taking significant risk in bringing people in and even getting to these buildings. I mean, it's falling in on itself. It's a strong building that from an exterior standpoint, it's not going to topple over. But we're talking about major, major structural repair to a building that dates back to 1870. This has been a part of our fabric from generations ago. We're talking about 140, 150 years ago, this building's been standing there. And people say, oh, it'd be great to see something happen with this block. It'd be great to see something happen. That's wonderful, you know, and it's romantic, but the numbers don't pencil out without some additional gap, whether it be a grant or multiple grants at times. I mean, these are projects sometimes that cannot happen financially without multiple grants, and still a lot of risk from the developer standpoint and the lender standpoint. So very complicated projects. It's not easy business.
20% as a tax credit is what we're talking about here on the federal level. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So on projects like that here, that for me calls to mind, you know, the Five to Revival you talked about recently, the Landmark Society has. You had this big roundhouse out in, where's the roundhouse, Larry?
It's in Wyoming County.
I mean, it's just a huge structure that, you know, ideally, Patrick, you know, we would have this free market system where, yep, if something's viable, someone can move in, can take on the risk, and can potentially enjoy the profits and the spoils of it if it goes well. But what you seem to be saying is there is that separate category of really dilapidated or really struggling or really large and historic or
right.
sort of uniquely constructed edifices, structures in Rochester and Western New York, really everywhere, that if there isn't help, nobody's going in there. Is that true, Peck?
Fact.
Okay. And so what happens to those structures if nobody goes in there?
They're lost. They're lost to history. They fall down. They continue to crumble. They get beyond a point of repair where even tax credits don't help them out. Sometimes people say, you know, mentors told me one time, Patrick, somebody could give me that building for a dollar and I'm overpaying significantly. You know, buildings are in such rough shape that you can't even do it when they're given to you. So these are buildings that need significant help. They're part of our fabric of our society, and without them, they'll be gone. I mean, history is lost. And that's okay for some communities, but for cities like Rochester, this is part of who we are, and it's such an economic engine if we can recapture these buildings. It really is.
All right, I know our other guests want to jump in, so let me kind of close the loop on a few things with Patrick Dutton, a local developer and broker who's focused on so much of downtown Rochester and involved in many of these projects. When people talk about revitalization of downtown Dutton, the name Dutton is involved in a lot of them. So Patrick, you talked about, you know, assuming that this is going away. Is that just saber rattling, or do you feel like we're looking at possibly halting a few projects right now downtown?
I think any smart developer who's looking at what's been proposed by the federal government, If they're not racing to get their projects grandfathered in and get certain amount done prior to the repeal of this, they're short-sighted. If they're hoping that it gets delayed or ignored or just incorporate it. They're making mistakes. So I have to race to get at least these two projects done. There's others that I would like to take on that maybe we just have to wait 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years until some program like this comes back. But I'm racing to get actually three buildings, two separate projects, but they're really three total buildings that won't get done without the tax credits.
And does that mean you have to get any sort of a shovel in the ground, or is that just getting paperwork done? Is that getting sort of a certain stage of development? What does that actually mean?
I'm still figuring it out, actually.
Daniel?
We have some details.
Yeah, go ahead.
The House proposal that rescinds the federal credit includes some very basic and rather stingy transition rules for the program. And there are surely, at some point, surely they will flesh these out. But at this point in time, we know the following, that you will need to own the building by the end of this calendar year. So that leaves 6 weeks left to, or 7 weeks left to acquire a building or secure ownership outright to transfer a lease to ownership situation. That's the first door that slams shut. If you do not own the building by December 31st, you will not be able to participate in the remaining months of the program. There was then a 30-month window to effectively conclude the work and basically bring the building through a qualified rehabilitation process. That could mean then, securing listing of the building on the National Register. It is all the paperwork that, the extensive and appropriate paperwork that goes into, proposing the scope of work, receiving approvals on that scope of work. That involves our agency as well as the National Park Service in Washington. And so suddenly even 30 months can seem like a very tight deadline for delivering a project and getting a certificate of occupation, of occupancy. So again, that's the current House proposal. The Senate transition rules are basically match that. And the development community is certainly at some point soon, if indeed we lose the program, going to insist on more detail and perhaps even more better rules for that transition, a longer time period. When this program transitioned from one format to another, 1986, there was an 8-year window for transitioning your building under the pre-1986 program to the rules of the 1986 program. So we're now looking at 2.5 years in comparison. So that's onerous, and that really is doing a disservice to a significant number of projects across the state that are pending.
And all right. So so who knows what's going to happen in the House vote tomorrow on the tax plan? But let me just sort of kind of role play a little bit here, because one of the things Daniel mentioned earlier is, yeah, there's been a lot of other issues tied to the tax plan that have gotten more publicity. That's just the way that it's been. It's been hard for the historic preservation tax credit to get the attention that our local developers and people across the state feel it needs. So Patrick Dutton, let's say I'm a member of Congress and I say, look, I got to vote tomorrow. And one thing I want you to help me see is, if you're going to get a 20% tax credit, help me see how this comes back. Help me see how this, pays for itself in the future. What can you tell me?
I read something I think the Landmark Society put out maybe in advance of today's meeting, talking about jobs and economic development that comes along with tax credits associated with certain buildings.
You guys want to jump in here too?
Yeah,
Dan McEnany?
The sort of simple facts of this is there's what is the heart of the tax credit and why was it created and why has it had some various forms. There's a great speech that you can find online of President Reagan talking very romantically about the tax credit and, how it instills a sense of pride in place in America. And these are good things. We believe in this. We believe in our main streets. We believe in our downtowns. But, the analytics that come out today show that for every dollar spent on the tax credits, $1.25 is returned to the Treasury. A vacant and abandoned building produces crime. A building that is fully utilized reduces crime by 25% in its surroundings. From an environmental standpoint, we've got these buildings that also have had a lot of hazardous materials introduced to them in the mid-century. And the cost of putting them in landfills is absolutely extraordinary. So you can go online and find, about 30 reasons why the historic tax credit actually makes complete sense, for Americans and their investment into the program. The numbers are there, the environment is there, The urban planning is there. So that's one of the things that a lot of people are not looking at in this big picture, is that we're not looking at something that is a entitled program for people. This is a program that has created affordable housing and supportive units for veterans and for seniors. It's not a market rate housing credit, although market rate housing, driving that into downtown, is incredibly important for its revitalization. So the economics are on the right side, and the social aspect is certainly on the right side.
I'm seeing some very interesting listener feedback. And listen, if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let me start with a little pushback, then we've got some from the other side. Tim in Pittsford says, when I need a new roof, I guess I'll call the developer for the money to replace it. I honestly don't mind my tax dollars going to some of these projects, but the issue is more that when the first thing a developer looks for is money from us taxpayers, it rubs us on both sides of the aisle the wrong way, especially when we have to foot the bill for our own repairs at home. That's Tim in Pittsford. Patrick, is that unfair? I mean, he's saying, you know, it rubs them the wrong way when the first thing you're doing is turning to the taxpayer.
No, I think it's fair for somebody to have that perspective. I mean, I speak with family members about the same questions. You know, they ask me, it's like, you know, it's similar type of comment from people around the dinner table. And I have to explain to them and really end up showing them, bring them to these sites to show them what it looks like today, and this is how it's looked like for 20 plus years for some of these buildings. And again, it's if a taxpayer is fine with losing that community asset, then they can vote. And, you know, I don't think any money should go to that project. But if they believe that a building that has been, that has stood the test of time and is important to the community, then they would, I think, vote in the favor of these tax credits. And it's important that some of these blocks, people, you know, the same people come and say, you know, well, I don't want to give any taxpayer money to these projects, to these developers. But then they also say out of the other side of their mouth, well, why can't our downtown do anything? Why is our downtown, why is there nothing to do? Well, it's because there's all these historic, difficult buildings to redevelop, and you can certainly come and bulldoze them all. But guess what? Bulldozing them costs more than the simple tax credit to help save them. And I think it's just education that needs to be provided to some folks that don't understand the process.
Okay, Dan.
But it's a fair comment, really.
Yeah, to add to this too, I mean, when you look at the various incentive programs out there, this isn't a grant program. This isn't, you know, a simple apply for it, get an easy 20% tax credit. This program is designed to have very vigorous review standards.
It's not easy to abuse it?
It's very difficult to abuse it. You can't just do whatever you want when you take a historic asset that's listed on the National Register. And developers have to spend an exhaustive amount of time and money to deal with the Secretary of the Interior standards to put these buildings back in service. So compared to maybe some other programs, I think that when you find this one, the review process being so extensive that you go through both New York State and the National Park Service to even get anywhere close to it, as we're talking 9 months to a year in just development there.
Well, let me underscore in response to that comment. This program does generate net positive revenue for the U.S. Treasury, 20 to 25 cents on every dollar awarded in credits, because the long-term benefits in terms of job creation, sales tax, reuse of local infrastructure. You know, this was a basic decision in 1986 that tax policy should be used to incentivize a certain type of activity, a type of activity that would be valuable to both community redevelopment and economic stimulus. And the program has proven itself that way in its current format since 1986. So this returns, you know, why we're wiping out a program that is critical to community revitalization and communities large and small across New York State, and why we're wiping out a program that ultimately generates net revenue for the federal treasury, that's just one of the illogical, it's part of the aggressive cuts that have to go into achieving a lower corporate tax rate.
Well, go ahead, Larry.
I think it's also important to talk about the quality of these projects. I was talking with one of the developers on his project. He was actually giving a presentation at one of our conferences, and he said that if I wasn't using the tax credit, I would have used a less quality window and my tenants would be hearing the noise from the highway. I mean, you're sort of forced to do a more quality project. I mean, so many of these buildings on our list have won awards from the Landmark Society, have won awards from the State Historic Preservation Office. I mean, they are really quality projects. And when you're looking at some of these huge buildings, I mean, take Sibley Square. I mean, that is a building that would just be standing there vacant. And
like it has for the past 20 years.
Right.
Right.
And it's only because of the tax credits that that will be, you know, giving so much energy to our downtown and, you know, helping with this whole revitalization.
You know, additionally, what we're talking here, and you talk about, you know, these are some high quality projects. What we're talking about is these are job creation mechanisms for skilled laborers. And we have a labor crisis here, and we have a dying of traditional trade and buildings. These are folks who come in to renovate these buildings, increase their own ability to further market themselves. You know, it creates both temporary jobs during the construction and then permanent jobs. So it's not your typical grab a crew, put together some 2x4s, create a new buildings, and new buildings can be terrific, but that this is really has a lot to do with the, you know, skilled labor force getting jobs in our regions. A
couple of emails. This comes from Jerry in Rochester. There is an irony in cutting tax credits or funding for historic buildings, even art. Great cities that attract tourists value and preserve their historic architecture, their works of art. They support them: London, Rome, Paris, Vienna, Venice, Berlin, Madrid, etc. But no, now in the United States, we do not value historic architecture or works of art. We have nothing to be proud of to exemplify our history and accomplishments in building or culture. Instead, we are as Philistines, and we are achieving the look of Soviet Russia and communist East Germany. It's Jerry.
Okay.
That's strong. Robert says, so just so we're on the same page, you're telling me that the same party that wants to preserve Confederate Civil War statues also wants to eliminate a tax credit to preserve actual historic buildings. That's from Robert. I'm not going to answer that, Robert. And I've got another email. Eric, I'm going to read your email after the break here because he's got a rather long email and a question on how sort of some of this works. We'll work on we'll answer that when we come back. We'll also open it up to your phone calls. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. We're talking about the fact that the federal government could be soon about to reduce or eliminate the federal historic tax credit, and that is a tax credit for developers, 10% to 20% for projects that often really don't get off the ground without it. Now, I'm not trying to do PR for them. That's how it's sold, and our guests are telling us that's exactly what happens here this hour. Sometimes it's historic old theaters or buildings, and we see it in Buffalo, Rochester, throughout the region, throughout the state, that are sort of older, harder to reuse or revitalize, and need some help to get off the ground with upfront costs. And these tax credits are designed to let developers do that, under the idea that eventually they'll sort of pay for itself. And the argument they're making is that it does. So we'll take more of your phone calls and talk to our guests when we come back on this subject next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the Next Connections, we sit down with the new sheriff in town. Todd Baxter won the election as a Democrat, defeating Patrick O'Flynn, the longtime Republican incumbent. But Baxter has said he wants to take politics out of the sheriff's office. He wants to focus on law enforcement, the opioid crisis, the jail, and more. What are his priorities and how to accomplish them? Todd Baxter, Thursday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, joined in studio this hour as we talk about the possibility that Congress could vote as soon as tomorrow to eliminate the federal historic tax credit. Larry Francer, Associate Director of Preservation for the Landmark Society of Western New York. Daniel McKay, Deputy Commissioner for Historic Preservation at the Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. Dan McEnany is Public Outreach Coordinator for the New York State Division of Historic Preservation. And Patrick Dutton is a local developer and broker focused on downtown Rochester. Here's Eric's email. He says, in my hometown, we have a fairly large historic district. In my estimate, it covers 40 to 50% of the structures in the whole town. These structures were mostly added to the New York State Office of Parks, Rec, and Historic Preservation in the 1990s. Although many of them are attractive homes, I question whether some of them are beacons of a particular style that deserve such preservation attempts. Many homes are almost exactly the same model as those nearby. However, these are certainly structures deserving preservation. My question is whether your guests feel there is a proliferation of buildings that are, quote, historic and maybe not the most deserving, and if so, does this balloon costs for the program? And he says, sorry if I'm ill-informed. Thanks for a tremendous program on this. That's Eric in Canandaigua. So, Daniel McKay, you want to start with this? I think he's starting with a question, and are we over-defining historic, and does that balloon cost for the program?
You know, my personal perspective, and I suspect it's sort of the professional assessment of staff, too, at the Division for Historic Preservation, is that there is still a great deal of landmarking to be done in New York State, that basically we still have undercounted our historic resources. And I do think the question gets at a bit, perhaps, of high style versus vernacular, you know, the best examples versus ones that have been, you know, more ordinary housing built for workers, lower income situations historically, or in simpler styles. And, you know, in the architectural history of any community is the accumulation of multiple styles over many years for all types of people and families. And so many historic districts really reflect a diversity of styles and ages, and a community like Canandaigua would indeed reflect that. And it's not just the mansions of Canandaigua, but a much wider variety of commercial and residential buildings.
How's the Landmark Society see this issue, Larry, about his question about whether we're over-defining historic?
Well, I mean, I sort of look at our 19th Ward. I mean, there are so many different styles within that area itself, and I think everybody in that area should be given the opportunity for the residential tax credit, which is not what we're talking about today, and it's not in jeopardy. Okay. Residential.
Okay. Let me get back to your phone calls, and this is Tom in Brighton. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I certainly support this type of tax credit, but I wonder if the pushback from people who oppose it might be that there might be a tendency to, for instances of corruption or special deals being made with certain interests to give them an economic advantage or a tax break. When the item or the building that they're trying to preserve really doesn't warrant preservation, but is to the economic advantage of the owner.
So this is a program. The federal credit is available on a statewide basis. If you are listed on this National Register of Historic Places, if your building is so listed, you are, and it's an income-producing commercial structure, you're eligible to participate in the program. It is. The credit really are the last dollars into a project. So after the construction phase, after it has been proven that the construction and rehabilitation standards have been met, these are the last dollars in. These are the last dollars awarded to a project. So these are not federal dollars that are awarded on the speculation of economic development or the possibility that jobs will be created or that some benefit will accrue in the future. The benefits have already been achieved through the construction phase, putting the building into service, and it's only at the time the building is put into service that the final reviews are in place to award the credits. And it's a program that really has a very high reputation. You know, it's been well recognized as a very effective economic development tool.
Okay. Tom, you want to follow up there?
Yeah, just, you know, how does someone or, a citizen verify that the right criteria has been used for the building to be cited for preservation?
Yeah. All of our work is overseen by the National Park Service, who sets very rigorous standards on first how we define a historic building. It can't just be 50 years old, but it has to maintain integrity. It has to be extensively documented for its association of whether it's a piece of architecture, an artistic expression, the work of a master, whether it had a significance socially to the development of a community. So we have to define them in, you know, very strict terms. and then to make sure that nobody is getting an entitlement just based on the fact that then they can get through the National Register, the whole building has to be rehabilitated using the Secretary of the Interior standards. And so that basically sets a further set of guidelines that doesn't let you, you know, whack the exterior of a building, put in funky windows that never would have matched and things along those lines. So there's really, and I think that, I think any developer could tell you, it is so, it would be absolutely impossible to try and get around a system that involves both a New York State public office and then the National Park Service. So the level of review and scrutiny is extremely high, higher than most credit programs that I'm aware of.
And Tom, this is Patrick Dutton, the developer on the panel, and you know, I got into this business because I partly just love these buildings. I love this community, and I started becoming more and more curious about how to redevelop some of these difficult structures, and lo and behold, there's a tax credit. So I start learning more about what this tax credit means and how it could impact the development of the project. I start looking at the State Historic Preservation Office website to learn more. I start looking at different districts, where the districts lie, what buildings are eligible for these tax credits, which buildings are not eligible for the tax credit. And it's kind of guided me to a point where I'm able to learn more about both the programs just through heavy research, and kind of allowed me to pinpoint certain projects and districts that I could focus on with this benefit in order to make a difference. So, I mean, part of it, I think what you asked is, how do I learn more? And I think there's resources out there both through the State Historic Preservation Office website and the National Park Service website as well. Yeah. Are those two good options for people to consider?
So what is motivating the Trump and the other opponents of this tax credit? What's their motivation?
This is Daniel. I think a great deal has to be sacrificed to get to across the tax code to get to a lower corporate tax rate. And these are all offsets that are being, you know, cuts are being proposed and cuts are being made that allow us to get to a lower base rate on both the personal and corporate income tax side. And a lot of good programs are being sacrificed, and this is one of them. The numbers don't work, particularly with the requirement that the budget be balanced in out years, or that the tax, the deficit not balloon by more than $1.5 trillion. So there's a lot of short-term, we're cutting a lot of, short-term positive programs in order to get to that, into that tax rate.
All right. So Tom, think of it like this here. There's an upfront cost that you pay to brush your teeth. You buy toothpaste, you buy dental floss. Well, some of you do, and you buy toothbrushes, and you brush your teeth. Now, you're paying for that. The idea is you're not going to spend thousands upon thousands on really painful dental surgery down the line when your teeth decay and fall out. If you wanted to save money up front, the idea is, well, we need to save and drip little sort of nickels and dimes. You can stop buying toothpaste and dental floss and toothbrushes under the idea that you want to save now. You want to pay for something else now, or maybe you doubt the long-term benefit. Maybe you think you're not going to get cavities. That's baloney. That the payback for spending up front on toothpaste doesn't really do anything. Well, that's sort of the argument here. The argument here is, number one, I think what you just heard from Daniel, that the Republicans in Congress and the Trump administration have some doubts about whether there is an actual benefit, a return on investment on these historic tax credits. And they're probably also trying to fill that budget gap that will be created by the tax plan that we talked about yesterday on this program. So it's probably a combination of those things. Now, that's for you, the listener, and to decide if you think the return on investment is there. Is that all fair, by the way, guys? Is that a fair representation of you think? I mean, the same way that when people say, well, you're spending now, how is it really paying for itself? It's paying for itself, the idea of more tax revenue down the line, development, jobs, multiplier effects, et cetera, et cetera. Andrew, one of our listeners, wrote to the program and said, who did the study? Daniel, you mentioned it, 20 to 25 cents on every dollar in sort of extra coming back to the federal treasury here. Andrew wants to know, who did that study? Was it you?
Not me. There are several national studies by economists and who have studied the program. One is Donovan Ripkema, who is based in Washington, D.C. Another major study is Robert Listikin out of Rutgers University in New Jersey. They have done the two big national studies, a lot of number crunching, using computerized economic measurements that are sort of standard formulas for that are used by other government agencies and the private sector to make such assessments. The National Park Service does an annual report, and more recently did a 25th anniversary report on the federal credit. So there's a great deal of documentation out there. It can easily be found online. RIPCMA, Listekin, National Park Service tax credit annual reports, and New York State consistently has ranked in the top 10 of user states over the last 10, 15 years. In the last few years, we've been number one for the last 2 years, number three years ago, 4 years ago. Our program use in New York State is accelerating, and most of that program use is now upstate. And this is, we're delivering a tool and an incentive for upstate communities that have long been lagging in terms of economic and community redevelopment. So it has been working here, and it's not just the numbers. I think the results are strongly visual as well. Buffalo is a different community now than it was 10 years ago.
Andrew Zemo also asked if there's a clawback provision. And let me get at what I think he means by that. And I think usually when we talk about clawback is if there is a subsidy for any kind of development and there isn't sort of a threshold of either jobs created or certain benchmarks met, that whoever got that break or that credit owes the taxpayers the money back. And I'll start by asking Patrick Dutton, if you as a developer think that would be fair in this case. I mean, there are certain projects you would not take on, as you've said, without this tax credit that you and a lot of developers wouldn't take on. Is it fair to ask for a clawback if you don't meet certain benchmarks?
Well, I think the clawback really is built into the program in the sense that, as Daniel mentioned earlier, it comes at the tail end of the project. The credits are only awarded after the project is complete. These are not early dollars coming in and the potential for this building not to get completed. At the very end of the project, in order to receive these credits, it's called a Part 3 approval. You've submitted your plans to the State Historic Preservation Office in Albany, the National Park Service in D.C. They've reviewed them at length. They've commented on them. You've had to make changes so that your standards are up to snuff and of very high quality. Then you build the product. After the product is built, then the Park Service comes through and evaluates whether or not you've done the job that was set forth that you've said you were going to do. Once you've done what you've said you were going to do, they give you the credits. So the clawback is really, this is at the tail end of the deal. I mean, these credits are only being given to projects that complete the projects as they say they would.
Okay. And you want to add to that, Daniel?
Yeah. And very few projects suffer rejection at the end of the process. I think that speaks to the quality of the rehabilitation work that's occurring. But if you
And of the vetting, I would hope.
And the vetting. And if you do not meet the standard that you committed to in the earlier phases of the application and review process, you will not be issued the credit. And that's a pretty high liability waiting for you in the back end. Indeed, you have to deliver a quality product as described, as proposed, and as completed.
Now, let me ask Patrick Dutton a super ignorant question then, because I am not in development. So when you talk about looking at certain buildings saying, we can see something beautiful and really powerfully important to a community here, but this is a building that's collapsing in on itself. Or if you look at Eastman Business Park and environmental issues, I mean, that's an extreme case locally. But there are places around our community where developers wouldn't touch it without help. How can you then, let's just take any building downtown, and this 20% credit is available, but it's only available on the back end when you're done. You're funding that project to get there on the faith that it's going to be what you envision, what you've laid out. So I guess it really relies on your work to be meticulous, and it relies on you to be able to fund it on the upfront side of it before you get that credit, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So simple as that once you know that credit's there, it can justify the work that goes into it.
Lenders, developers, architects, people, all the project partners are making their business decisions based on the fact that they're going to complete the job as they say they're going to complete it, and that tax credit is coming. So if by chance it doesn't come, if you started the process, and it would ruin a project.
Okay, so Dan and Daniel, you've been across the state. We're talking Finger Lakes, Rochester, but you're across the state. What are some other places where you've mentioned Buffalo, where things stand out to you, where maybe even our listeners would be aware of that you can say, look at what happened here. Look at the difference.
Sure. I mean, we've seen things sprouting up all over. And we did some statistics about where we've been breaking this down. Daniel's mentioned a couple times that two-thirds of this is all in upstate New York. From my 10 years experience in the office, our program really started with, you know, seeing so much happening in New York State, Macy's, the Empire State Building, massive investments in Brooklyn, and these were all kind of terrific, and it would be one or two buildings upstate. I would say almost every major city and region has had in the impacts of $200 to $300 million of investment. Places in Binghamton, in all through the southern tier, Olean. It started with urban planners and developers being motivated to list their downtowns as historic districts to then start bringing individual buildings in. City of Albany at one time was nationally in the mid-80s the highest user of tax credits, and that was all to create a downtown that was all based on creating office spaces. Now nobody wants as many office spaces on their upper floors, so the City of Albany is coming back in to start creating more residential uses to kind of enliven their downtown. So there hasn't been a place that has not been touched, particularly through what will be Congressman Reed's district, looking in places like Corning and Elmira. Mm-hmm. Entire downtowns right now have been, I mean, there's going to be, I always think there's a point we're going to run out of buildings, but we're certainly not. And the downtown impact has been great, but then the legacy of industrial buildings that we've left behind have been these go-to historic resources for people to get them up and running for, you know, these multi-use hubs of, you know, residential, makerspace, and bringing industry back. It's sort of been interesting how people have recrafted these industrial places in Amsterdam, New York, to come back alive with totally new uses.
All right, let me grab another phone call. Steve in Brighton next. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, hi, Evan. Good conversation here. A man from Canandaigua called in earlier, and he questioned whether some buildings may be high style enough or nice enough to worthy the tax credits. And I just wanted to respond that buildings like this often contribute to the whole, and that in many cases they would contribute to a cohesive block or a cohesive neighborhood. And as a local example, I would give the Abel's or Abel's building at the corner of Gregory and South Avenue. Many people thought that building was not worth its landmark status, which we gave it 20 years ago or so. And that building sort of began a revival of that neighborhood, and you can't argue with that when you go over there to see it today, where Mise en Place is and all of the wonderful businesses around it. So sometimes rehabbing and spending money on a building that seems less worthy than others is often a wrong way to look at it. And that's all I had to say, okay?
Yeah, Steve, thank you for the phone call. In fact, I recognize that voice. That's someone who knows his stuff in this subject. Thank you, Steve.
Right.
Dan,
okay.
McEnany?
You know, I want to say that the discipline of historic preservation is not about a beauty contest at all. And when I started doing this, I remember somebody who was getting prepared to retire and said, I got to get out of here. We're going to start nominating ranch houses on the National Register. And I said, ranch houses can be great. They're awesome. They're mid-century modern. But he said to me, you know, when I started in this field, I started because we were tearing so much down because of urban renewal. But when we tried to nominate Art Deco buildings on the National Register, the Park Service told us they weren't 50 years or older yet. So it's a reminder that this is an evolving discipline, and we're going to be looking at, and we continue to look at, buildings that are 50 years or older, and what is their architectural significance on our landscapes. And right now we're at 1967. We're approaching a point where some of the most despised architecture, including brutalism, is now eligible for...
Including what?
Brutalism, you know, which is large concrete structures right in our downtown.
Xerox Tower. and not a bad example.
And these buildings too, although little appreciated by, you know, even myself at times, are going to have different perspectives as people move on. And therefore, if this program moves forward, also eligible for historic tax credits. So it's, I gotta always emphasize, it's not about the prettiest building.
Let me real quickly read one more email from Jerry. Says, this issue is about values. This tax credit has to be only a very small percentage of a national budget, and the opponents of the tax credit do not value these matters. The money element has to be relatively inconsequential. Clearly, the gains from the program evidence the cut is not about the money and the cost to the federal government. Jerry thinks this is a value statement. Larry?
Yeah, I was going to point out that I really do think that your listeners and, you know, just plain old folks all around the country need to understand, or I think they would understand, that this is really about community development and neighborhood development. You know, when we're leaving these huge buildings untouched because we can't afford to do them, we're not able to use a tax credit, it's a blight on your neighborhoods, and the neighborhoods will not be safe. The neighborhoods will not be able to grow. And I think that's one of the most important things about this.
Well, Larry, we've got a diverse group of listeners. Some might not be swayed. Some might be swayed. I want to ask Larry and Daniel as we get ready to close, for those who are swayed, what do you want them to do? I mean, Congress could vote on this tomorrow, right?
This program represents 0.03%. The national cost of this program represents 0.03% of the intended $1.5 trillion tax cut. And we need to let Congress know as quickly as possible, make the phone call, hit up the website right. of your congressional representative, send the email, and say, we can afford to, you know, we can't just, we can not only afford to keep this program, but it is critical to offsetting a budget deficit, renewing the economy of our upstate communities and cities, and the time is now. The call needs to be made now. The email needs to be sent today.
Our thanks to Daniel McKay, Deputy Commissioner for Historic Preservation at the Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation out of Albany. Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for coming in.
Pleased to be here.
Dan McEnany, Public Outreach Coordinator for the New York State Division of Historic Preservation. Thanks again, Dan.
Thanks. Enjoy talking.
Larry Francer, Associate Director of Preservation for the Landmark Society of Western New York. Thank you, Larry.
Always great being here.
And
thanks.
Patrick Dutton, a local developer and broker who has been focused on so many projects downtown, and it will be interesting to see, you know, what comes of this and what comes of your work going forward. But I know you got your hands on a lot of very interesting things. We'll talk to you again. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Our thanks to John Andrus, the engineer, Audrey Sample, the intern, Megan Mack, producer, all of the wonderful crew at City 12. I'm just the guy with the microphone. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.